Committee on Finance will come to order. And we have a series of bills that, finance bills that are here, many of them that actually are in the process of being processed. So Senator Sharon, I think we'll start with your bill, Senate File 347. Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is a bill that deals with the ability of states to collect child support payments across state boundaries and in other countries. And the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act sets rules for the enforcement of family support orders by setting basic jurisdictional standards for state courts and determining the basis of state exercising continuing exclusive jurisdiction over child support proceedings. It establishes rules for determining which state issues the controlling order, and the event court proceedings are conducted in multiple jurisdictions. And by providing rules for modifying and refusing to modify another state's child support order. In 2007, the United States signed the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Family Maintenance. This convention contains provisions that establish uniform procedures, and it encourages states to adopt those procedures in order to avoid consequences in terms of federal participation in child support efforts at the state level. This bill is a bill that does that and is supported by the American Bar Association. It is necessary for the state to be compliant with the federal and Uniform Law Commission requirements, and it's been recommended to pass by Judiciary. This is a finance division, so you have a fiscal note. You can see that it indicates that as of today's date, there is not a fiscal implication.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. We, quick as we have a quorum, we'll adopt the division report. If we could just go back, I think this is one of the interesting bills that relates to international law and how different countries work together. And we saw with the bombing out at the Boston Marathon, at least in some of the news items that came out, the negotiations and information sharing that took place between several countries, Russia and the United States and other countries. You know, many of us, myself, did not realize the extent of what's all happening between countries. And obviously the world is well interconnected. But how do we enforce like child support collections across the country or across the world?
Well, now, I did not anticipate a question such as that, but if I could get Mr. Tennyson, who was here earlier but has disappeared on me. If you're out there somewhere, Mr. Tennyson, please come in to come in and answer that question. Maybe maybe Senator Latz, who was here too, could also.
Senator Latz is just right behind you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Hear the question first.
We can't progress without Senator
Latz. Question is how do we collect child support internationally? Is it through the governments, or how's the process that works?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon. I don't know the precise process, but there are international treaties that I know relate to implementing laws that are in different countries. Part of the point of this bill is to streamline that process and to give effect to the process so that people who need their child support can actually get it.
Senator,
I couldn't tell you the details of the process.
Sharon. I we have processes in the United States for collecting child support. And this law has to do with an agreement, the Hague Convention, those who participate in it, applying whatever their processes are to assist in the collection of child support across these geographic boundaries, and also honoring the terms and the conditions of the state where the collection is to occur. So I do know that the processes that we use are the ones that we would apply when implementing this for other countries. And although I can't say that for a fact, I would assume that each participant, each country that participates in this convention, and all of the subsystems, like the states, would utilize whatever laws and rules they have to implement to support the child support collection.
Okay. Any other questions that members have?
Okay.
Mr. Nauman, could you just touch on the fiscal implications in this bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members. The fiscal note was completed on the 3rd of April, so it's been thought about for a few weeks already. I'll highlight for you that the effective date in this bill makes the language effective when the treaty, when the United States ratifies the Hague Convention Treaty on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Open Forms of Family Maintenance. And the department has made the presumption, in other words, because it's got an open-ended effective date, the costs, well, maybe Mr. Turner can help me. I think he spent a little more time with this one.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, because nobody knows, DHS nor the courts know exactly if or when this is going to pass. So, and in addition, the courts don't really see it. They see it having an impact on their workload, but not a significant impact. DHS has approximately $50,000 in programming costs, but because of the effective date being unknown, I guess would be the way to put it. They haven't requested an appropriation for this bill.
Senator Sharon, you mentioned that the United States has adopted in 2007 the Hague Uniform Recovery or International Recovery of Child Support. That's not the defining point in time?
No, it has to be ratified by both Congress and Senate, and that process has not been completed as of yet.
Right.
So this establishes us in the right position once that occurs.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I understand that this is changes to a uniform law. Is that correct?
It really is a participation in a convention that is an agreement between the members of the Hague Convention to support each other in cross-geographic boundary collection of child support.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
is there a financial impact? I looked at the fiscal note, and it seemed to be blank. So,
Mr. Chair,
let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, you're correct in noting that as Mr. Turner spoke to, the courts will have some increased court staff time, perhaps some judge expenses. Based on the numbers that they make and the assumption, there's only about 4% of the statewide court filings that would be effective once this does become effective. But because the treaty hasn't been ratified, the effective date remains nebulous until such time if and when that occurs.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator
Sharon, I guess the next question would be is the timeliness of advancing this particular legislation. The U.S. government hasn't made an agreement due to its representation at the Hague Convention. Why is Minnesota going forward with this now when it's not even recognized by the federal government?
Senator Sharon?
Well, the my understanding is that that the United States has signed the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Forms of Family Maintenance, and it establishes these uniform procedures. It has to be ratified, that's true, but once ratified, then we would be in compliance with that. We won't be in compliance if it isn't or until it is, and it establishes us to be have met the obligations of the Hague Convention. And the updates to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act that were implemented in 2001.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer,
this doesn't really have, or at least for the federal purpose, this doesn't have an impact until the Senate ratifies that treaty, and I am assuming that it's the same standard as any other treaty. 60% of the U.S. Senate has to vote in favor of a treaty to ratify it. So we're kind of still in the preliminary phase awaiting the ratification.
This is the agenda.
Is that a proper understanding, Senator Sharon?
Senator Sharon.
I don't know that I can affirm what you're saying. I do know that the United States has signed the Hague Convention, and it's a matter of ratification. I don't know about the preliminary phases. I think that that's a it is an action. I think one of the houses has, in fact, taken action on this and ratified it, but they're waiting for the other house to complete its work.
Members, we do have the division report before us. Senator Latz, do you want to move the division report on April 4th? Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Limmer's question, if we wait until Congress acts to ratify the Hague Convention, then we come back and have to go through our own legislative process. There could be a substantial delay, maybe a year or longer, for the ability to effectuate these support orders. According to the fiscal note in the Supreme Court's analysis, there were 600 to 700 case filings for registration of foreign support orders in Minnesota, about 4% of the statewide family case filings. So, some percentage of those would experience delays in being able to enforce their support requirements. And that means single parents, presumably of children, are not getting support for some additional delay period of time. I wouldn't want to be, just because we don't feel like taking action now, I wouldn't want to be responsible for that. I think it makes sense to be proactive and be prepared. And so they can get their support as promptly as possible.
Mr. Chair.
Good point. Senator Limmer, and then we're going to go back to the fiscal report.
This question is for Senator Latz. Senator Latz, right now we have adoption actively being conducted now without the involvement of this convention that agreed on some new terms. We have the existing uniform law that I believe this is an amendments to the uniform law. So I'm not so sure if all foreign adoption is in some type of cessation at this moment. But I'm just concerned, does this have, by us passing this into law, would that mean that we have our own agreement with those that have signed this Hague Convention, or are we signing it and then awaiting the U.S. Senate to ratify, and then we will automatically be on that moment fully enacted?
Well, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, Senator Sharon might have a little more detail on this, but this doesn't specifically apply to adoption. It's family support cases. So child support is what we're looking at, number one. And number two, this will help the Supreme Court enforce existing child support orders when the obligor doesn't live here. And I think that's really important. Now, which it'll apply to only the countries that have ratified the Hague Convention and so on. And making individual determinations of that is beyond really the scope of what we can do. What we can do, however, is make sure Minnesota law is in a position to give the Supreme Court or our district courts the full ability to enforce those orders. And I don't see any downside to it.
Okay. Mr. Nauman, you want
to? So, Mr. Chair and members, in looking through the assumptions that the Department of Human Services made in preparing the fiscal note, there is a little bit more information that might bear on this question. On page 3 of their work, under the assumptions, they cite that Congress is expected to amend the federal laws governing state child support plans to require that all states adopt the UIFSA 2008 in order to implement the convention. They further go on to say that after Congress adopts the federal implementing legislation, states that do not enact UIFSA 2008 will be considered out of compliance with federal law and in jeopardy of losing the federal. That may bear on the question that you were wrestling with.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, we heard a little bit of brief testimony that the agencies don't have an appropriation, and I'm not sure if that's because they don't know what it's going to cost. There's some numbers in here, but either they're willing to absorb those costs if they come up, or they don't know. Is that accurate, that they're willing to absorb the costs that this may have for them?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's what I assume. They've got an estimate of $149,000 in implementation costs, of which a state share is approximately $50,000. I would estimate that they would absorb that cost.
So, Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, so have you heard from Human Services and the Supreme Court they're willing to absorb these costs? Are they in favor? Are both these agencies in favor of this session?
Senator Sharon?
I have not heard from the Supreme Court, but I have a fiscal note that has been prepared by DHS that I'm using as my indication that they're indicating a zero fiscal note at this time.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Lantz.
The only other point I would add is that part of the reason it's a zero fiscal note is because they don't know what fiscal year even to place the cost in, because they don't know when this will be effective. I suspect that whatever time it does become effective, we might see a request from the department to help subvent some of the costs at that point. But, you know, we do this for other things as well. The Board on Judicial Standards, when they do an investigation, they don't know in any given year what complaints are going to be filed and what investigations they're going to have to engage in the coming biennium. So in the judiciary budget bill that we've passed out of this committee, there is a $300,000 backfilling of their investigative costs, because now they know what it costs to do the investigations. They come to us to pay for it. So I would put this in that same category. It might be down the road, if the costs turn out to be something the agency is not in a position to absorb, that they'll turn to us asking for some help with it, and we can consider how to handle it at that point.
Mr. Tennyson, a very timely entrance. We're struggling here to pass Senate file
347.
You got any? I shouldn't say struggling. We're good discussion. So,
I think just to orient Mr. Tennyson, we're talking about three things: why now, rather than wait until a ratification? What about these costs that might occur, which are difficult to articulate because the date of implementation isn't in place? And then, if we know anything specifically about how it is enforced, those seem to be the three critical questions.
Welcome, Mr.
Tennyson. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm one of the uniformed law commissioners from Minnesota, and this is a product of the conference. And just a little bit of background, the state adopted the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act several years ago as a means of enforcing child support among the states. And basically it clarifies the means by which support what court is determined to have jurisdiction to avoid the fights that previously occurred. Congress, when it was faced with the child support issue, instead of creating another level of family law on top of the state law, they told the states to adopt this act as a means of enforcing child support. And the states have all done that. And they conditioned that on receiving federal funds for enforcing child support, as I understand it. And in 2007, President Bush signed an international treaty dealing with international child support. And there's several ways for the treaty to be enforced. One is self-enforcement, the language of the treaty takes care of it. Another is federal legislation to implement the treaty. And the third method that they've chosen here is to have the states implement the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act as a means of good faith compliance with the international treaty. And that's what we have here. And so ultimately, we're going to have to adopt the Uniform Act in some fashion or other. And so rather than sitting and waiting until Congress actually acts, we'd like to get ahead of the ball, because I think it will happen this year. Last year, Congress and the House of Representatives passed the act. Senate never got around to it. This year, the Senate is acting on it. We expect the House to do so shortly, too. And I'd hate to put the committee through all this work again just to repeat what we've already done this year. So I'd appreciate it. I think in terms of the cost, my understanding is that there may be some cost for reprogramming if and when this happens. But I also understand the department is considering reprogramming or doing some new computer stuff anyway. So that's where we're at.
All right. Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, in the For What It's Worth department, I will freely confess that I am not an enormous supporter of uniform laws. However, I do see this as an exception. I think I would be in favor of this particular uniform law, whether or not Congress adopted a bill requiring states to pass this law. And I say that only from the standpoint of parents who are obligated to make child support payments, irrespective of where they are residing. I think we in the state of Minnesota should do whatever we can to make it as easy as possible to run those folks to ground and require that they pay their support payments in accordance with our laws. So, like I say, this is, for what it's worth, if it gives any of our members of this committee any comfort, I am somewhat familiar with this particular uniform law, and I do support it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Any other questions that members have?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomassoni?
We're just wondering whose signature that is on the division report.
Where?
Where?
Let's see. It came from.
Whose signature is
it? Can't read that.
This is the worst signature in the universe.
Sure.
Senator Latz, do you want to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be delighted to move that Senate File Number 347 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor.
Okay, on Senator Latz's motion, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sharon and...
Do we just adopt the committee?
Okay. Next, we'll take Senate File 647. Senator Ortman.
Do we just adopt the committee report? Or both of them?
I was reading.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Did we just adopt the committee report? The committee report, did we also adopt the bill?
I believe the motion was for...
We'd already adopted.
We had already adopted the committee. Okay. Yeah. I came in late, so I apologize.
Senator File 647. Welcome, Senator Orton.
Greetings, esteemed Finance Committee members. Greetings from the Tax Committee, which is in meeting right now. And so when I'm done here, we'll head down there, and we're working on the omnibus tax bill. Senate File 647 is a bill that comes out of the Judiciary Committee and earned the support of the Judiciary Committee through two hearings and also through the Health and Human Services Finance Division. What it does is it addresses a criminal justice issue Members, we have some folks that have been in our jail, in jails with mental illness, and they have unfortunately waited weeks and sometimes even months for the adequate care and treatment that they deserve. And so what this bill does is it sets a mandate of 48 hours that a person that has been ordered to treatment because they need restoration to competency or because they have been civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous, that the commissioner of the Department of Human Services must take them into their care and custody within 48 hours. This bill before you has been amended a couple of times in recognition of the concerns that have been raised by the Department of Human Services, by the sheriffs, by the county attorneys, and by the National Alliance of Mentally Ill. All of those folks have weighed in. The language that you see before you is a consensus bill. Everyone is supportive. They are here in support. Sue Abderholden from the National Alliance of Mentally Ill is here. Jim Franklin from the Sheriff's Association and the Department of Human Services are here to testify in support of the language that you see before you. Also, the fiscal note. We worked very hard to develop a fiscal note that reflects a zero impact. And so I am hopeful that this committee will support the effort of all these folks that have come together to find a solution to providing this adequate care and treatment to these folks that deserve it and have been ordered to this treatment by our courts.
Senator Lance, would you? There's actually two division reports. Senator Lance, do you want to move the division report from the Judiciary Committee?
So moved.
Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. We also have a division report from the Health and Human Services Division.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lance.
Can anyone verify whose signature is on that report?
We know for sure that it's not yours. The division report, Senator Lance moves the division report on from Health and Human Services. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. All right. Mr. Nauman, anything on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, members, it shows no cost. I don't know if Mr. Turner has anything he'd like to add.
Okay, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the original bill had cost to DHS and some savings to corrections, but and that was because they specified that they had to be housed in a certain security level. The division report doesn't specify the type of facility or security level required, which gives DHS more flexibility and which eliminates the cost.
Okay. Members here that might serve on the Capital Investment Committee will be talking about the security hospital down in St. Peter this afternoon. So, okay, so there is no impact. Any questions that members have? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question of Senator Ortman or Mr. Turner. Just curious about the language. I'm just reading it for the first time, so I apologize. In Section 2, persons presently confined, it states that, starting at the bottom of the first page, unless the person has elected to be confined in a Department of Corrections or County Correction or Detention Facility, under Minnesota statutes, et cetera. What is that? I'm just curious. I don't have any dispute. I'm just trying to educate myself. What is that trying to accomplish, that provision?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, folks that have been convicted have some ability to choose where they will be confined, and sometimes they choose to be closer to home than in a particular facility. I believe that's what that language refers to.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I think that particular section was amended out.
I thought it was too,
this
Mr.
year
Chair.
Committee. So what the committee should refer to for the content of the bill would be the 647 division report from the Judiciary division, plus a delete everything amendment.
reminder to read the committee reports and not the...
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
The choice to choose the confinement is current law, but Senator Latz is correct that that was amended out, and the current version that I have is dated 4/12/2013 was the date that we pulled it. It was amended last in the Judiciary Committee. It was not amended in Health and Human Services.
All right. So actually, we only have the division report from the Judiciary Committee too.
We have both.
Mr. Chair, it was a delete everything.
Any questions? If not, do we have a motion?
Senator Bonhoeffer. Mr. Chair, just a comment. I appreciate you bringing this forward. I have had a constituent who was in this situation, and the amount of duress that he experienced because he was not in the proper place for his mental health took years to recover from. And in fact, it was my first year that I was here that it happened, and it's just now that he writes me with an update that he's doing better, he's recovered, and it was really quite traumatic and life-changing, and so I appreciate that you're bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Limmer. So, Senator Ortman, the division report dated April 12th from the Health and Human Services did not make any changes. So what we have, members, is really the division report from the language that is now Senate File 647 is the language from the division report from Judiciary. And Senator Limmer moves that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Ortman.
Thank you all so very much.
We have Senate file next, Senate file 654, Senator Wicklund. Welcome. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you.
Senate File 654.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. I'm here with Senate File Number 654. It is a bill that has modifications to provider notification and medical assistance prior authorizations for certain services and providers. And when we had this bill in Health, Human Services, and Housing Policy, there was an amendment. And then we brought it to the Finance Division, and that particular segment of the bill was removed. And that was the only section that had any financial impact. So the remaining bill language does not have any fiscal impact. It's all technical changes, and I can have... Director Leitz can speak to the bill if you'd like to know more about it.
Senator Lori, would you move the division report?
I move the division report on Senate File 654.
Okay. On Senator Lori's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Lori, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm looking at the agenda. I looked at it last night, and I see that there's a lot of work generated from this committee out of the Health and Human Services Division. And maybe I'll just give a minute to describe to members what we went through in our division and why many of these are here. Many of these are actually included in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill as well, but we had to adopt a procedure where we dual-tracked some of these provisions. In case the House took a different approach to deadlines than they have historically, and that the Senate has, and once they reached second deadline on policy, they said nothing could come out of divisions any longer. So even if it didn't have a fiscal implication, it would have to be wrapped into their omnibus bill. And so I needed to keep those in my division to put in the bill. But in case the House decided to take another tack later on and let some of these out and go to the floor, I would just as soon not carry all of this policy in my Health and Human Services omnibus finance bill. But understanding that it's likely, if the House sticks to its the interpretation of the deadlines, these would, in order to survive, would have to be in my omnibus bill. So we're moving them to the floor. If the House changes their interpretation and lets some of these go, then they can be run separately and passed on the floor and passed into law as policy provisions. But currently they are also contained in the Health and Human Services omnibus finance bill. So
thank you, Senator Lurie. Once again, the House causes a few problems for the Senate.
Well,
thanks for the description. So we have a no-cost proposal here. And would you like to make a comment? Or?
Mr. Chair, Scott Lights from the Department of Human Services. Only if there are questions, Mr. Chair, on the bill.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was having an amendment drafted. Is that – I don't have the number. I don't have a copy, so I don't – but I'll offer that, whatever number that is.
Senator Nino, is it to this bill?
Yes.
A-9 amendment.
A-9. And Senator Wicklund, my apologies for not connecting with you beforehand. I couldn't find you. But it doesn't do dramatic things, so don't worry.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Senator Nino, once the amendment is handed out, would you like to go through it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In brief, what this amendment does is it would effective July 1st, 2014, if the Department of Human Services hasn't implemented a comprehensive statewide single administrative structure and delivery system for non-emergency medical transportation, which is currently required under state law and statute. If the department has not done that by 2014, this would require that they send out an RFP to essentially implement that. If the department gets their work done, as is currently required, this would not take place. The department would do whatever they decide they want to do. This just simply basically would create an incentive for them to get that done. And Mr. Chair, this isn't coming out of nowhere. As I indicated, it's currently required under state law. This is something changes in this delivery system is something that was recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They audited the non-emergency medical transportation. And again, this doesn't require the department to do anything as long as they decide what they want to do before July 1st, 2014.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. This is a policy issue. I'm thinking this should probably go through the Health and Human Services Policy Committee because this is quite a big deal. It's a big issue. There's a task force that's meeting on this and has been meeting for about a year, and it's a huge huge issue and a huge problem, and the current contractor is that the department had actually was paying with a grant rather than going through the contracting system is got some questionable practices in the past and some problems with it, and I think this is an issue that needs a lot of discussion, and the department, if they haven't already, needs to be talking about where they are at so far with this task force. I was on it for the first year that it was going on, and then I think in last December they extended it to be meeting as a regular group regularly to try to get this issue going. We did an awful lot of work on trying to figure out how to make this non-emergency medical transportation system work statewide a whole lot better than it's working right now at less cost than what we're all paying right now for it. So as I said, I think it's a huge issue, and I don't think we want to necessarily make changes in this bill at this time because it's a big policy issue, and it's also going to be a big financial issue in the long run. So I would ask to lay this over or send it to Health and Human Services Policy Committee rather than to put it on this bill at this time. No disrespect to the senator, because I think he's got to, you know, I think it's necessary to get this task force going to get these changes made. I definitely believe that these changes, there's big changes that need to be made to this. I'm just wondering if this is the time and place to do it. There are other senators and state representatives on this task force as well, and I don't know that we've gotten a report from them yet because I'm not on Health and Human Services, but I would just say this really does need some good discussion, and we do need to do something about the system the way it is right now.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senator Goodwin is correct. This is a very important issue, and there has been a task force that has been meeting for some time on it. And it is my belief, my understanding, that the final recommendation from the task force is in. I think I could go back on my computer and find it, and I'm thinking that it was sent into members of the task force back in about January or December. And so I would speak in favor of the A9 amendment simply because there has been a lot of study and a lot of effort gone into addressing non-emergency medical transportation, and we should probably get off the dime and do something about it because it is a system that needs work and costs the citizens of this state a pretty fair amount of money. I want to say $37 million a year. I would speak in favor of the amendment only to require the department to move forward on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I would encourage members to vote against the A9 amendment. I understand Senator Enow's point in trying to push the department to make sure that they act appropriately, but it's troubling to me. I don't know this independent third-party evaluation committee not affiliated with the Department of Human Services makes me quite nervous. I don't know if this entity exists or who it is that we're referencing, and then it goes beyond that, and it says that this, again, independent third-party evaluation committee that's not even affiliated with DHS shall be responsible for evaluating proposals and making final determinations regarding contract awards. You know, that's a pretty significant delegation of authority to somebody that we don't even know who it is right now. I think that's probably pushing harder than is warranted, but I do understand the intent of pushing to take some action, but I think this probably goes into an area that would be a pretty bad precedent to allow independent third-party groups to be awarding state contracts. So that's something that should trouble members deeply. So I would encourage members to vote against the A9 amendment.
Senator Dibble. And then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nino, I'm mostly with you because I do think we need to do this. But my question is maybe to – I think Senator Newman started to make this point, but I would like to know just in a little bit more detail, do we have some indication that the department with the input and effort of this advisory task force is not going to meet this July 1st, 2014 deadline? Is there a strong indication that we need to push them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe we have the task force chair here who could speak to that okay. more directly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I have, I don't know if it would be the pleasure of serving as the chair of this task force. As many of you know, I have worked on many, many task forces and chaired many of them. This, by far, has been the most difficult one I have ever served on. However, that being said, we have finally, I think, come together, understanding all the different parties' perspectives, yes. Their problems, the resources that they bring to the table, and we were actually making progress in terms of coming up with things that we could all agree to. We ran out of time, and partly it's because, again, this was it was hurting cats in many respects because people, you know, they had their own very strongly held positions, let's say. But we are scheduled to meet again. I believe our next meeting is in June. We plan to come back. We actually created assessment questions that we all agreed to, which I think was a, you know, a huge breakthrough that everyone would use, including the prepaid health plan. So we are making progress, and I would oppose this amendment at this time. If we don't make any progress over the summer, I'd love to come back and then, you know, and then use the hammer, but I actually think we're making progress now.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Senator Newman and then Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Aberholden, what report am I thinking of then that came in and was disseminated to the task force members back in December or January if it wasn't the final report? I am certain that we received a report, and I thought it was the final recommendation.
Ms. Aberholden.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman. It might have been the what we've agreed to so far, but I don't. But I know our work isn't done, and I have a meeting on my calendar for June.
Okay, then I stand corrected. I thought it was a final recommendation from DHS on the non-emergency medical task force. Apparently, I am mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, you're correct in the sense that I think what was presented to you and to the legislature was the progress that had been made to this point, the points that could be agreed upon. What the task force also recommended, and it's to Chair, to Ms. Abderholden's point, was that there was good progress being made. They couldn't get to all of the issues, and so requested an extension for an additional year to continue that work. As Ms. Abderholden said, there was, I would say, a substantial amount of progress being made on an issue that, frankly, needed a lot of work. And so what the bill right now reflects is what's been agreed to so far, but there does have to be some additional work. But we do believe there's been a lot of progress made, and we anticipate being able to bring back a full set of actual changes to the program to next year's legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ninau, or Senator Bonhoff, do you have a question for?
Well, no, it's a question for Senator Ninau and a suggestion.
All right. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ninau, when you first introduced this, you said that there was statute on the books requiring this to happen. Is there a date in law that this is supposed to be done by?
Senator Ninau.
You know, I'd have to look it up. I don't recall that.
Is there anyone who's here that does know that answer?
Yes.
I think the department can answer that better, but I think that was supposed to be done by this January.
This past, yeah. Mr. Chair, this
Senator
past
Bonhoff.
January, and that was what the extension
Correct.
Was? Okay. So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
I support the intent of Senator Ninau's amendment because I think enough time has lapsed as I hear the conversation to take action to bring this matter to completion. I also understand Senator Lurie's concern with regard to this outside third party, and it seems to me that Senator Ninau perhaps put that in there because he had some concern that the department was not coming up with the action and the conclusions that we were looking for. So I wonder if a suggestion might not be to use the resources of the Commissioner of Administration, which has oversight and accountability for many of the contracts and bidding processes, and perhaps Senator Pappas would know that, but rather than say, upon the completion of an independent third-party evaluation committee, that one could say the Commissioner of Administration, in consultation with the Department of Human Services, shall be responsible. Just a suggestion, because I think it's important that we respect the jurisdictions of our agencies and not insert someone without that expertise, but perhaps that might be a compromise.
Okay, Senator Goodwin, or Senator Ninau on this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, if staff wanted to come up with language that would work along that lines, that would be fine with me.
Okay, Senator
We can incorporate
Goodwin.
That.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. And to Senator, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Bonhoff's comment, I think the situation right now with the current contractor is that there was a grant given they were originally under contract, but in order to get that same contractor back, which we've had a series of problems with and so have many other states, somehow or other, this same contractor keeps getting the contract. And, in fact, this last time it wasn't even a contract. It was done through a grant process to avoid some of the issues that they'd have, some of the things they'd have to go through in order to get a contract. So I really just want to say that because I want it to be made public because that's not the appropriate way to do these kinds of things, and it's a very big money contract. So I certainly understand Senator Ninau's point on this, and I do think they do need to get this work done. And they do now definitely need to put this out, however they decide to do this, for competitive bids as soon as they figure out how to do this and not keep it with the same contractor and be giving him that particular contractor special rights to this contract.
Would you like to make a comment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Frenette, and I represent the R80 Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Coalition, Coalition of Non-Emergency Medical Transportation, for people who need these, out in the rural areas of Minnesota. Anyways, we are opposed to this amendment. We have been working very closely with the work group recommendations, and they are not part of the work group recommendations. We believe significant progress has been made on these recommendations, and we feel by 2014 we should be able to be where we are.
Okay, what's the committee's intent? Senator Nino?
Well, Mr. Chair, the concerns that have been expressed, with probably the exception of Senator Lurie. I won't say with the exception of Senator Lurie. The concerns that have been expressed are legitimate, with the exception of Senator Lurie's concern. There really are moot if the department does its job. Senator Lurie's point, I can certainly understand his comments there and Senator Bonhoff's recommendations, and I see some activity over there. Staff may be working on some language, and I'm perfectly fine with keeping that in-house, so to speak, and not having that non-governmental, non-state department entity involved. The intent there was to just get an outside view, but we could certainly do that and keep that within state government. So that's perfectly fine with me. Once we get that language, I'll withdraw the A9 and reoffer it with that incorporated in it. But I think it's important for everyone to understand that the concerns that we're hearing, everybody is saying we can get this done by 2014. Then none of this applies. This just makes sure that if they don't get it done by 2014, something does indeed happen. And if this isn't the best approach, the department is incentivized to find a better approach and get that done. Because we're spending a lot of money here and not necessarily effectively. Other states that have had made changes have saved tens of millions of dollars in many cases. And this is something that needs to happen. It was supposed to happen this year. The department thought they were going to have things for us this year. Commissioner Lice testified in the House and said, we thought we could get it for you this year, but we couldn't quite get it done. But we're going to work on it over the interim, and they're going to come back next year with something for us. So they say they're going to do it. This just creates that additional incentive, and none of this applies as long as they get it done.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I do have some suggested language for you if you want an amendment that would accomplish what Senator Bonhoff described. On page 1, line 13 of the A9 amendment, or delete line 13 of the A9 amendment, and then on page 1, line 14, delete everything before of and insert the Commissioner of Administration in consultation with the commissioner, so that the new language would read, the Commissioner of Administration in consultation with the Commissioner of Human Services shall be responsible for evaluating all proposals and making final determinations regarding all contract awards.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Bodern, wouldn't you still want to have the first part of that sentence? Wouldn't you want to say upon the completion of the formal bidding process? And then insert the Commissioner of Administration in consultation with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff,
Senator Council.
I think that's could safely be assumed, but if you prefer it, I don't think it does any harm. So
thank you.
The amendment, in order to do that, on page 1, line 13 of the amendment, delete everything after the comma and insert, and then the remainder of the amendment would read identically. Page 1, line 14, delete everything before of and insert the Commissioner of Administration in consultation with the Commissioner of Human Services, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bob.
Okay, Senator Nino.
Mr. Chair, if you've, staff has that all written down, I will withdraw the A9 and reoffer it with that language incorporated into the A9.
Okay, the A9 amendment is withdrawn. The language that you just heard, does anyone want to hear it again, Senator Lurie?
Okay.
On that amendment, okay. Before we vote on the amendment, there seems to be on 1.7 and 1.8 that language there would drive a cost. Is that correct, Mr. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, we believe that is correct because what would in reading the language, and I hadn't seen this before, on 1.7 and 1.8 would require us to create a capitated payment rate. That would require us to figure out what the capitated payment rate should be, and that would involve some expertise that the department doesn't currently have in-house. That would be something we would probably work with an outside actuary on determining that rate.
Do you have any idea what the cost would be?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific number. I don't believe it would be substantial. But it would involve some level of cost, probably relatively modest, but I don't have a good sense of that.
I see.
How would you describe modest?
Mr. Chair,
above or below $100,000?
Below $100,000.
Is that something that the department can absorb?
Mr. Chair, not typically.
Oh, gosh. A question.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, what was the thinking in having it be a capitated payment versus non-capitated? Would that get rid of the cost?
Senator Bonoff, the purpose of a capitated payment is to transfer financial risk from the state to the vendor so that the vendor currently on a fee-for-service arrangement, the vendor is incentivized to provide more services regardless of whether they're really needed or not. With a capitated payment arrangement, the vendor is incentivized and required, presumably would be required under the contract to provide those services that are necessary and adequate, but is disincentivized to overprovide services because they are taking on that risk rather than the state. That is the purpose of a capitated payment. Now, I think everybody agrees that when we do that, we're going to save money. At bare minimum, if we took the money that we're paying today and say that is the capitated amount, that wouldn't involve an actuary or a consultant. At least we wouldn't spend more. I think it would be easy to shave off $100,000 or $200,000 off of that figure and assume that we could get contracts for that amount and still get this done without having a net cost to the state and not being at risk for spending more. I think anyone that's knowledgeable on this could assume we could shave off significantly more than that for a capitated rate and have a net savings. But we certainly could outsource this to a consultant and an actuary and spend a lot of money on it, and by a lot, maybe $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and probably come up with millions in savings, more than likely.
All right, members, here's what we'll do. We'll vote on the amendment that is before us, and if the amendment is adopted, then we'll just lay this on the table so that we can get a fiscal note. It won't delay the path of the bill very long. It's not a huge effort to get the fiscal note, but that's what we'll do. So on the amendment, any other discussion? Senator Lurie?
Well, I guess it's not on the amendment, but if it is passed and it does produce a fiscal note, I guess I'd like some clarity at some point where that'll be carried, the cost for it and whatnot. But I think I know the answer to that question.
All right. Senator Sharon?
I thank you very much. I know it's unusual to have Senator come to the table, but I am on this task force, and I've been involved with, for a long period of time, with the concerns about non-emergency medical transportation. And I agree with Senator Nienau that to heighten the message about the seriousness of this and the frustrations that are occurring within the provider system as well as those who use this service is important. But having said that, when I hear this discussion about this payment method, for example, what it incentivizes and what it doesn't, this is a very delicate thing. If we incentivize people to, by our payment method, a broker to do that, to restrict access to people who really need this service or to restrict the appropriate level of use because there's a benefit to them if they spend less on a capitated system, we really need time to think that through. And as the chair of the Health Policy Committee, anything that is that significant a change, I think, deserves a longer conversation and a full analysis of how it impacts the actual service to the people who have a right to this. What we're trying to work on is a system that is appropriate throughout the state. There's differences between the metro and the rural area in terms of unloaded miles, in terms of what is available in, as alternatives to the more expensive treatment programs. So it is a complex issue, and while I really appreciate this committee's increased interest in this and frustration with a lack of reasonable resolution and with the system that we have in place, I'm very concerned that a change like this at this time without us taking it back through, especially a payment methodology, without taking it back through a committee hearing process for analytics might create an outcome that we don't want. So as you move forward, please be careful about this because it is complex interplay between parts of the state, between the different capacities of parts of the state to meet the non-emergency medical transportation needs. And that's why it's been difficult for our committee to be able to come up with a single system, because a single system sometimes doesn't work statewide.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I hear you saying you'd rather hear this in your policy committee than have us adopt an amendment today that's going to have an impact on what your committee's jurisdiction is. Is that right?
Okay. Any other discussion? On the A9 amendment that with the changes in it. All those in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion is not adopted. All right. On the on the Senate file 654, which includes the division report from Health and Human Services, as amended, all those in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The same sign. Motion is adopted. And so that will be sent to the floor. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
All right. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Leitz. So, Senator Hayden, Senate File 976. Welcome, Senator Hayden.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill.
Senate File 976 is a conditional release of nonviolent offenders if they receive treatment. The history of this bill, members and Mr. Chair, was originally passed into law in 2005, and it had a sunset in 2008. The sunset subsequently extended to 2009 and then again to 2011. The sunset was not extended in 2011. Senate File 976 revives 244.055. The original goals of the Conditional Release Program, or CRP, were to encourage chemical dependency treatment among offenders whose crimes were tied to addiction, while reducing the prison population by allowing early release to eligible non-violent offenders who successfully completed treatment after an initial specified period of incarceration. Senate File 976 retains other important safeguards of the original 244.055. Offenders must serve at least 36 months or one half of their sentences, whichever is less. Offenders may not have been previously released under a CRP or have a conviction for a violent crime defined in Section 609.1095 in the past 10 years. Offenders fail to complete the required chemical dependency treatment will have the time they spent in the program added back onto the term of their imprisonment. Offenders granted early release will be monitored on intensive supervised release, or ISR, subject to return to prison at the discretion of the commissioner without a hearing if determined that they pose a danger to the public. The prosecuting attorney and sentencing court will be notified and given an opportunity to comment on the offender's potential early release. Mr. Chair and members, there was a fiscal note on this, and it showed a savings, not a large savings, but a savings. And I think that what else it has done is it starts to get us to take a deeper look again at who's in our prison systems and try to make sure that those that are there that have their sentences tied to addiction, that we do everything we can in order to try to get them treated and to see if we can reenter them in society. So I think that it is a great opportunity. It's something that we've done before, and I'm hoping that the committee members and the chair agrees with me.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Latz.
I move that we adopt the division report.
Senator Latz moves the division report on Senate File 976. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
The Judiciary Budget Bill contains funding for an additional 100 chemical dependency treatment beds in the corrections system. That is in part to support reinstating this particular program. This is a good bill, and public safety is well protected in its circumstances. And you know, 90% of the people in our prisons have chemical dependency problems. That's mostly how they landed there in the first place. So if we can give them a chance to get treated and get back in the community and show they can do a good job there, then we're all better off for it.
And Mr. Chair, I do have one amendment. When appropriate, it's just a technical amendment, but it's at your pleasure.
Why don't we deal with that now, Senator Newman?
Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment, and the A1 amendment on page 2, line 16, deletes license and inserts certified. I know that they're passing it out.
Senator Latz moves the A1 amendment. Get that handed out.
This was requested by the Department of Corrections, by the way.
Mr. Chairman, could Senator Hayden tell us what it is again? You're about ready to vote.
If you look on the bill draft, page 2, line 16, the second word is licensed. That's deleted, and certified is inserted. Okay. On Senator Latz's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Motion is adopted. All right. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, or maybe Senator Latz. It looks like this is a reenactment of a prior chemical dependency release program. Can you give me any indication as to the success ratio of the program that we are reenacting? There must be, I would think, some studies maybe the Department of Corrections has, or you know, as to whether or not what we are about to do was successful in the past.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'm reading on the page 3 of the fiscal note. Says the DOC research indicates a 72% completion rate for those offenders ending chemical dependency treatment program. It's assumed that the level of security, a level of service inventory, revised LSIR, would be used to assess offenders' risk. Goes on to say that that these folks are very low risk. Between 5 and 10 is considered low risk. So I don't know if there's somebody from the DOC who can continue to help me with that.
I can add to it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
The DOC's numbers and numbers from research studies in other states as well have shown that inmates who successfully complete chemical dependency treatment while in custody have about a 27% reduction in recidivism once they're released. So I would think it'd be even greater under these circumstances because these are low-risk, nonviolent offenders in the first place.
Senator Latz, does that individuals are they sentenced because of a crime related to like a DWI or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, these are controlled substance crime convictions. Yeah, either first, second, third, fourth, or fifth degree controlled substance crime. So they're drug related.
Okay.
Convictions, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And off of that same point, how many of these convictions are of, and maybe Senator Latz can help me with this, with the reduced nature with regards to the dealing of street drugs, where they actually take a reduced sentence to plead guilty to possession alone? And that's the concern that I have. Been working in that business a long time, and I certainly am all in favor of trying to get somebody recovered. I think I've talked to Senator Hayden about this before. Maybe I have and maybe I have not. But the bottom line is, if we don't get them on a path to recovery, we're gonna keep paying and paying and paying, and lots of dollars are going to be extracted out of the public to keep these people incarcerated. And I get that. I really do get that. I used to be the guy that turned the key and lock the door, throw away the key type attitude, and that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. But I would be cautious one of the questions that I have here, Senator Hayden, is that you said the ISR folks are going to be covering the costs, so there's going to be intensive supervision release here, and I certainly understand that too. But is there not going to be a cost to somebody here, like the local units of government, or is it going to be the state that's going to have to incur that?
Senator Hayden.
So, well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, as I was listening to you, I also was advised by the Department of Corrections that one, folks that have been convicted of distributing large amounts of drugs would not be eligible for the program, and that so that kind of gets that alleviates some or gives you some comfort in terms of who would be, and also there wouldn't be a tremendous amount of folks. Right now, it's about 5 people. So as you think about the cost of intensive supervision parole agents, it'd only be about 5. But once again, in my opening, I think that it starts to get us to reinstate a program like this really starts to get us to thinking about who's in our prisons and sorting them out or triaging them, if you will, from those that really have gone to prison because of addiction. And continued addiction and continuing to get caught with substances that's feeding their addiction versus those that have been profiting off of selling controlled substances.
Chair, just
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, I understand that. And one of the assumptions here is the Department of Public Safety or Department of Human Services will be responsible for all the costs associated with the conditional release program. Did I hear Senator Latz say that?
Mr. Turner.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen. That is in the bill description or the assumptions by the Supreme Court, and I think that's erroneous. Under this program, the Department of Corrections, they're committed to the commissioner, and if they complete treatment in prison and fulfill all the other requirements, they are released, and they're under the supervision of the Department of Corrections. I don't see any time here where DHS or DPS would come in contact with these guys. And that was not part of it wasn't part of the DOC assumptions in the fiscal note. It was part of the Supreme Court's assumptions, where they said that it is assumed that they would pick up certain costs. I don't know what costs they would be talking about.
Okay. Is that there's someone here from corrections? Do they agree to that?
How are you, Commissioner?
Please give your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Roy. I'm Commissioner of Corrections.
Welcome.
Thank you,
Commissioner. The question was. Did you hear that,
Mr. Chair? I did hear the question, and I agree with Mr. Turner that assumption by the court system is probably erroneous, and I too cannot imagine any costs that they would incur.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor this very long, but the commissioners here appreciate you coming. Does this appeal to you as a good program? Continue.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have long been beating the drum of treatment in prisons and recognized that it is a public safety issue, and I agree with you also that simply turning the key does not do the trick, that we have a responsibility to treat and improve as often as we can, and this certainly is a strategy to do that. You will note that the criteria are very strict and somewhat reduce the number of potentials that enter the program. But we feel that any treatment and any individual is worth saving if we can.
A question that comes to my mind is, Senator Latz, you earlier mentioned that the number of inmates that get into our correctional system because of a drug-related crime or a drug-related use, I should say, is quite high. Commissioner, is that true with both the men and the women?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have completed a rather robust research study regarding chemical dependency and chemical abuse. And in both male and female offenders, it approaches 90%. And as a young probation officer so many years ago, I once surveyed my caseload of felony offenders, and I determined that 95% of my caseload, either the individuals were high at the time of the crime or had a significant treatment history prior to committing the crime. And it is an element that I wish we had a solution for.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says in the guidelines here, it says the offender may opt into these programs. So even though we provide this program for them, they're not mandatory to go into them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair. Senator, that is correct, and unfortunately, we do not have adequate treatment beds to meet the need, and some offenders simply choose to do their time and not take advantage of anything offered to them, and that is one of our system dynamics.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so how many people that do offend that are low risk, as is mentioned here, actually subscribe to or take on the program if it's made available? And then how many people actually, once they get into them, because you mentioned it was strict, actually will finish the program?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, those numbers vary from program to program. Compliance within programs can vary. This particular program had, when it existed, had a fairly high level of completion. Other programs, not so. But at the end of the day, the real question is how many people that complete treatment stay out of our system totally. And we have, I mentioned that previous study about chemical dependency, and we have found that the effect of treatment conservatively is 20% reduction in recidivism. And if that treatment continues while they exit treatment or prison and continue treatment in the community, it even is better, approaching 30% reduction. So it varies from program to program and from system description and criteria.
Senator, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
So, Commissioner, this is all assumptions.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, we believe our research is based in the best available. Our Dr. Grant Dewey is our head researcher, and the results have been over a long course of time, thousands of offenders, and I think the research has proven without doubt that treatment does help in reducing recidivism.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate, too, Senator Ingebrigtsen's point, line 1.17, 1.18, that says it has to be result of controlled substance addiction and not for profit, to make sure we don't allow the dealers to be taking advantage of this program. But I wondered if Senator Latz or the commissioner could tell me, you said it's the type of substance abuse you listed, I think, 1 through 5 or something categorically. Could you just let us know what kind of drugs are we talking about, and what percentage approximately, just rough, would be in the various types of drugs that we're talking about?
Senator Latz?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can answer all the question, but, I mean, controlled substance crimes, first degree down to fifth degree, can run the gamut from all the different, the scheduled controlled substances, can be medications, could be cocaine, could be methamphetamine, could be heroin, could be marijuana in sufficient quantities. It could have been a trace of some of these, or it could have been, you know, larger quantities of some of these. So the common element that's guided in this program is that the connection to the crime was addiction to the controlled substance, not sale. It doesn't exclude sale-related crimes, but if your sale is related to an addiction that you have, then that would qualify for the criteria for the program, I assume. The commissioner can probably get a little more detail. And I have no idea what the various proportions of the different degrees are.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I ask partly because I have a workhouse in Plymouth, and I've toured that and asked questions about the crimes that most of them were serving, the particularly the women's and men's and in the men's, and learned that you know, much of it was, for example, marijuana. And so I'm just wondering how much of the time our prison population is there for marijuana-related offenses versus some of the more serious, I guess serious is a value judgment, but narcotic-related.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think if we profiled the typical drug offender in our prisons, we would find that they have had multiple experiences with multiple drugs. And probably the most common amongst our offenders would be alcohol as the preferred substance of abuse. But in these cases, I wish I could give you exact numbers, but again, it's a poly-substance abuse issue. And when you throw prescription medications on top of abuse, it becomes an even more complex issue. And by the time the corrections system ends up dealing with many of our folks, they are well into many years of abuse. So this is a pretty much an end-of-the-road kind of approach. And we wish we could get to people earlier in their abuse cycle, but unfortunately we don't.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Members, I think what we should do is try to wind up and move this forward.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that.
I think Senator Newman was first. Did you have a question, Senator Newman? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to try and keep this really to a short question and hopefully a short answer. Commissioner, you had indicated that there was about a 20 to 30% reduction in folks returning into the system, depending on the treatment program. I really feel pretty strongly that these treatment programs do work, and I have felt for a very long time that the war on drugs doesn't work. Can you give us an idea of the rate of recidivism for folks who do not go through one of these treatment programs as compared to the 20 to 30% reduction?
Mr. Chair, that comment. To that comment.
Okay, Senator Goodwin.
We're getting pretty heavily into the policy here, and we really went through this in detail in the Judiciary Committee, so I'm thinking we should probably get back to the whatever financial issues we
Senator
have.
Senator Goodwin, I think this is this is a little bit of an education for all of us. So, and it's a big problem because this afternoon at 3 o'clock when the Capital Investment Committee meets, we'll be talking about treatment programs as well, which the requests are relatively large, needed but large. So, Commissioner, on Senator Newman's.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, comparing offender groups gets to be very difficult, but generally and I don't even know if I dare to throw some numbers at you because it is such a complex issue, but clearly successful completion in prison treatment reduces recidivism. That is improved even more greatly if that treatment continues upon release and into the community. It varies from offender group to offender group, type of addictions. Obviously, meth is a drug that has received a lot of attention and certainly is one that takes a long period of treatment for success. Some other substances, success rates in different modalities work far more effectively. So I'm going to beg your forgiveness and not give you direct numbers.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you want to move Senate File 976?
Real quickly, one comment, and it has nothing to do with the question. But financially, it does have something to do with what could potentially come here. And it's just important to know when the commissioner talks about some that don't want treatment, I've got a couple of examples as well that I said, "What do you?" And he was a trustee. Both of them were trustees. I said, "When are you going to quit drinking?" He says, "I'm never going to quit drinking. I'm just going to quit driving. I just have to quit driving." But he no way indicated that he wanted any treatment. He'd been drinking since he was 12 years old, and he was in his 40s. So there are those that are just going to do that. And until they finally figure out not to drive, I guess they're going to cost us money. But I'd be real cautious. When you talk about low-risk criminals here, I just remember that the drug consumption and the drug trafficking is all about gangs. Gangs cost us a lot of money. They're horrible. There isn't anybody in this room that wants gangs. We'd love to see them just all go away. But I understand the treatment mentality. I mean, we just really have to do that, and 30% has always been that norm, it seems. So I'm not against this at all. I just say move cautiously when you talk about drug crimes, low-risk drug crimes, because a lot of these folks have been involved. If they get into the state prison system, they've been involved a long time. It isn't just a county thing anymore. It's a state system, so they probably know a lot about dealing or been around it. So just move cautiously.
Was that a motion?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Latz moves that Senate File 976 as amended be recommended to pass. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, members, for the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's an education, and thank you, Senator Hayden, for presenting it. And it goes to the floor. Okay. Senator Miller, Senate File 941. Senate File 941, we have a division report from Senator Lurie.
I'll move the division report, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lurie moves the division report to Senate File 941. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Miller.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 941. This is all about the Region 10 quality assurance. And I can walk through the bill quickly if members would like. The fiscal note did come back at zero, and I believe that this is also being carried in Senator Lurie's omnibus bill. And so we're dual tracking, which is new to me this year. So it's in two places. So that's a good thing. We want to make sure that this language gets passed. What is the pleasure of you, Mr. Chair, and the committee? Would you like me to run through the bill quickly?
Senator Miller, if you can just tell us about it a little bit.
Okay. So right now DHS is in the process of moving toward a new state quality management system, and they're going to utilize a lot of what's currently being done in Region 10 quality assurance. Current law has a sunset date for Region 10 quality assurance of June 30th. Let's see here. June 30th, 2014. So what we're doing is we want to delete that sunset date to allow Region 10 Quality Assurance to continue to operate until the new state quality management system is in place. A couple other changes in Section 1, Lines 2.12 through 2.15. The State Quality Council has begun the process to develop a plan and form and implement regional councils with an anticipated completion date to be as far off as July 2016. So Senate File 941 allows providers to have the choice to opt into the system, even if their county does not, and this is a case in Winona County. Winona County has decided not to opt into the program, but we have organizations that within Winona County that do want to opt in. Section 5, line 3.18, members of the quality assurance teams currently receive a stipend. There are some members that want to just volunteer and do not want a stipend, so this language allows for that. Section 7, line 4.21, Region 10 Quality Assurance utilizes alternative standards approved by DHS licensing for services specified in this section, Section 7, C1 through 6. DHS is in the process of developing new standards for services listed in the section. Senate File 941 provides language to ensure that Region 10 quality assurance standards will continue to be the standards for the quality assurance licensing system. And let's see, Section 8, line 6.11, current law says that the State Quality Council must develop and transition plan for Region 10 quality assurance providers by July 1st, 2013. The transition plan will not be completed by July 1st, 2013, so Senate File 941 removes the date, allowing for an extension.
Okay, Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, this was largely an extension of a really valued program, and it was non-controversial in Health and Human Services. I applaud Senator Miller for bringing it forward. Would move Senate File 941 be recommended to pass.
Okay. Senator Lurie moves Senate File 941, and were no amendments.
There's no alternative.
Any other questions that members have? If not, on Senator Lurie's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Miller. Okay. Senator Thompson, welcome. Get all those taxes raised downstairs.
We're doing our best.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I've got a couple of bills here. I don't know which one you have on the schedule first. You let me know which one you'd like me to do.
We'd like to have you tell us which one you'd like first.
All right. Well, I'll be very strategic about this. Senate File 712 is on the top of my stack, so we'll go with that first. How's that?
Okay, Senate File 712. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I won't go too deeply into the specifics of the bill for obvious reasons. We're here for finance, but what this bill essentially does is it extends protection currently afforded to certain peace officers to also include prosecuting attorneys, judges, and in one case, the Commissioner of Corrections. The bottom line is it gives these people who are obviously involved in protecting the public safety and sometimes working with some pretty rough folks it gives them an elevated level of protection under the criminal law dealing with murder and also violent offenses. This bill did have some changes, and with the changes, there were no objections to it. And obviously, if your staff would like to speak to it, that would be fine, but I would make note of the fiscal note that was prepared on April 2nd. Of this year that indicates there is no fiscal impact, but since the note was requested, I was asked to come through the Finance Committee. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would take questions from you or any of the members.
Senator Latz, there is a division report. Senator Latz moves the division report from the Judiciary Division. Any discussion? All those in favor? On the division report,
yeah,
Senator
Mr. Chair, Ingram. Just a question of Senator Latz before we move that. Was there discussion in your committee with regards to anybody else, not just the Commissioner of Corrections, but corrections officers? Were they considered under this at all? Or I see prosecuting attorney, so that kind of covers the whole gamut of county attorney, city attorney, prosecuting attorney. As well as defense attorneys, were they discussed on this,
Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, there was some conversation. I'm trying to remember whether or not correctional officers already have some special protection relating to assaults. I'm not certain about that.
Senator Thompson.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Senator Latz, if you weren't done.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz and Senator Ingebrigtsen, there was a discussion as to whether or not the category or group should be broadened. My recollection is the same as Senator Latz's. I believe there already are some provisions for corrections officers and the scope of their duties. I don't remember exactly how that was resolved. I wish Senator Ortman were here. I think she talked some about that. And with respect to defense attorneys, that actually was brought up by Senator Hall, and it was decided not to do that because while obviously they are in a position, and Senator Latz can speak to this better than I can, that sometimes carries with it risk, the idea here was to try to take public employees that are specifically tasked with protecting the public from the actions of these individuals. And then also Senator Ingebrigtsen and members, we wanted to be very careful not to start spreading this out where there was no clear line. And the clear line that we drew in Senator Latch, you can comment on this if your recollection is different, is that we were looking to protect those individuals that are specifically assigned to, in the case of prosecutors, bringing the evidence against people who in many cases may be violent individuals, or in the case of a judge sentencing them, punishing them. And so we kind of felt like that was a clear place to draw the line so that this wouldn't end up expanding beyond what any of us intended.
Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just reading on 1.22, it says, or after the correction, it says a guard employed at the Minnesota State or correctional facility or a person engaged in the performance of official duties, they've crossed out peace officer or guard. So that segment of people looks like it's already been covered. And but I understand what the other areas that you're trying to get at.
Thanks for coming.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, again, just to comment, and knowing where the ultimate decision is made by the prosecutor of the agency as well as the commissioner, and I know where this comes from. Most recent, shootings certainly of homicides in another state with regards to a corrections commissioner. But it's the line staff, the ones that work with them every day, or the assistant commissioners or the assistant prosecutors. I think they're covered, yes, I understand. You could pretty soon you're gonna expand that into a little bit of everything. But they certainly work with those, and when they get out, there's been many threats made. I know the correction officers as well that when you get out, this is going to happen to you and that's going to happen to you. So it's something that I would like to work on in the future for whatever. Thanks.
Okay. We have adopted the division report. The fiscal note, Mr. Norman, is we haven't taken action on the division report. Thank you. So Senator Latz moved the division report on Senate File 712. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Mr. Turner on the fiscal.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission noted that these are fairly rare cases. There's only 317 judges, so when we included the judges, which we went sent it back for a second fiscal note, it came back identical to the first. And not only are they fairly rare, but they're enhancements. These are already crimes. They would already be convicted and sentenced anyway. And so sentencing guidelines determined that there would be a minimal caseload impact, whether beds at the prison level or supervision at the community level. And that is why there's no appropriation listed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Any other discussion on this? If not, Senator Latz, do you want to move this?
I'll move the bill.
Okay. Senator Latz. Move Senate File 712 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Thompson. You have a second bill, which is Senate File 874.
Yes, and first on the previous bill, thank you, members, and thank you, Senator Latz, for your support working with me on this bill. All right, on to Senate File 874. This bill did generate a bit more controversy to give a thumbnail to the folks in the room. This deals with civil forfeiture, and members are most likely aware that if an individual is charged with a criminal offense, a civil matter, a civil case can be brought about that results in instrumentalities of the crime, whether it's drugs, automobiles, whatever the case may be, being confiscated from the individual and ultimately kept by the state. This was brought to me, and I was a little surprised to find out that actually in the state of Minnesota, you could literally be arrested, lose, for example, your car, never plead guilty to an offense, never be found guilty of an offense, not even agree to go into any kind of a program, a redirection kind of a program, and still ultimately, if you don't bring a case to get your property back, lose it. So essentially what this this bill does in its essence, and again, we're here on the fiscal impact, so I won't go into too much detail on the merits, but the bottom line is this bill, if it's ultimately passed and signed into law by the governor, would require that for an individual to lose his or her property, there would have to be some sort of offense that was either prosecuted in a guilty finding by a jury or some sort of a plea to a guilty or at least some sort of a program acknowledging that a wrong had been committed, so that people who literally didn't even have a charge brought against them, were not prosecuted, and didn't plead guilty to anything, wouldn't lose their property. And once again, the fiscal note on this is zero. There's an indication that there would be no fiscal impact. And so with that, Mr. Chairman and members, again, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Before we move the division report, any questions? Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Dribble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, every now and then you get a bill in this kind of area that generates a lot of controversy. And over the weekend, I heard from a surrounding city mayor with regard to that. Her police chief was concerned. I've since visited with both my police chiefs and am in receipt of a document from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, and the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, all who object to this bill. And so given that this is in an area of law that is so directly related to their ability to do their jobs, it does concern me. And I do recall when we made some pretty significant changes in this area of law over the last couple of years in response to the controversy and really the scandal associated with the Metro Gang Strike Task Force. And what they tell me is that those changes so far are working and that they are concerned that going in this direction actually will inhibit their ability to do their jobs in the way that they see fit. So for that reason, I do have to support the professionals in this area and say that I'm hoping we don't move the bill today.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to observe the authors of this bill, Senator Thompson, Latz, Hall, Torres Ray, and Limmer. This is the great unity bill of the session, with some exceptions, I guess. But I'll just give my speech in favor. I think it's a good bill. We need not repeat the kinds of circumstances people found themselves in the aftermath of the gang strike task force scandal. It's not how our public safety officials inspire confidence on the part of the delivery of their professional services. You know, that may have been, those may have been folks, you know, who are poor and on the margins who are subjected to that sort of treatment, but it has implications for all of us. I think this is a good step.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I wish that Senator Bonhoff would listen to the analysis on the other side of the issue before reaching a final conclusion, because I would submit that this is not going to end forfeiture as we know it, despite the pronouncements of the people who sent you letters. Right now, in most criminal cases where forfeiture is allowed, forfeiture does not take effect, is not allowed by statute until after there is a conviction for the underlying offense. What this bill does is extend that same principle to controlled substance crimes. That's essentially what this bill does. It does not say there will not be a forfeiture, and it doesn't say anything about where the proceeds from the forfeiture go, which is another, what was and still is another point of contention, because you have law enforcement agency heavily dependent upon for their agency funding, even for their regular duties, upon the proceeds from forfeitures, which creates a conflict of interest, a fiscal incentive to pursue forfeitures that may or may not be completely justifiable. But that's a separate question. This bill doesn't go there. What this bill simply says is that you're not going to lose your vehicle or lose your property until you've been convicted of the offense that the statute says leads to forfeiture. Otherwise, what you have is, and this was one of the problems with the Metro Gang strike force, but you have cases where the property is worth $500 or $1,000, and it's simply not worth the financial payment by the owner of the property to challenge the forfeiture, which they have to do under current law in a civil proceeding in order to recover their property. If it costs a filing fee, and in some bills right now, in the House bill, it's proposed that conciliation court filing fees go up substantially, or if you feel you need to hire a lawyer to do that, people right now, they throw up their hands and they say, it's just not worth spending the $500 to recover my $500 vehicle. Yet for them, that $500 vehicle may be their only means of transportation, the only way they can get to work easily. It may be beyond their means to afford a $15,000 vehicle. So there's good reason why we should at least wait until there's a conviction for the crime that then justifies the forfeiture. In most cases, the only impact is going to be a delay from day 60, which is the deadline for filing the civil forfeiture charge or complaint, until there's a conviction for the offense. Maybe in a 30-day, might mean a three-month delay before the forfeiture can take final effect and the forfeiting agency can dispose of the property and recover the proceeds from it. In some cases, there won't be a forfeiture at all. But which would also be appropriate if there's not a conviction. Then what's the justification for taking the property? To me, there isn't enough justification without a conviction.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would echo both Senator Thompson and Senator Latz's analysis of this matter. We ought not to be able to take away private property from people without that necessity of a conviction. But having said that, and so that I don't goof this up, perhaps Senator Latz or Senator Thompson could address the difference between the administrative forfeiture procedure and the judicial forfeiture procedure. I think there's a difference here, but I candidly can't remember what it is. Or perhaps Mr. McGrath could. I just don't remember off the top of my head what the difference is, but I think it plays a part in this overall discussion.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, if it would be all right with the chair, I think Mr. McGrath probably could do a better job of explaining some of the nuances, or perhaps Senator Latz. I don't practice personally in the area of criminal law, and I think one of these gentlemen can probably do a better job on that than I can. Lee.
Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Lee McGrath, the Institute for Justice. Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, this bill only affects judicial forfeitures. The difference between the two is when the presumption is that the state can take the property through an administrative process without a court hearing. That is an administrative forfeiture. But if the property owner files a case, McGrath versus 2007 Chevrolet Impala, then that process is converted to a judicial forfeiture and it goes to court. To Senator Latz's point, about 67% of the time, no one files that civil lawsuit. The property owner does not convert from an administrative process to a judicial process for the economic reasons that Senator Latz is right. So this is only affecting this bill only affects about a third of the forfeitures, those in which the conversion from an administrative process to a judicial process takes place.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen, and then I would like to have Mr. Turner just talk briefly about the fiscal note.
Thank you to Senator. Some of Senator Latz's concerns with regards to, and I think in part and place to Senator Dibble's support as well here. It seems like this Metro Gang Strike Force bad apple keeps coming back to haunt us here in the legislature. And I know that there were extensive meetings with regards to that, and I was part of that, and it was very clear that they had some bad actors here in the Metro Gang Strike Force. And it was on TV and still continues to be on there occasionally. And we also had testimony from the rest of the state of Minnesota. I brought in a couple of rural task forces that I dealt with. I think somebody else did from the southern part of the state, where they're actually working. They actually are carrying themselves the way peace officers should. So here we are, knee-jerk reacting to something that just never seems to go away. With regards to Senator Latz's fundraising or money or figuring it in their budget, personally I have to take some offense to that because I was part of that process some years ago, and we never, ever budgeted how much property we were going to be able to take away from anybody for any kind of a case. If it came, it came. If it didn't, it didn't. It's similar to years and years of rural communities saying, you know what, LGA is 50% of our budget. All we've worked that into our budget. Now we've learned to depend upon it. That's not the case at all. County attorneys are against this. County sheriffs are against this. I don't know if they testified against it, Senator Latz. But this is another tool that has been used. And yes, it sounds scary that we're able to take law enforcement or county attorneys and prosecuting attorneys are able to take property away from people who generally it's proven in court that have not worked a day in the last 10 or 15 years, and they have all kinds of assets. And guess what, folks? Guess where those assets come from? They come from dealing to the drug folks that are now in prison and Senator Hayden's dealing with in his bill. You know, it's just a never-ending process. And because of the Metro Gang Strike Force, we once again visit this. And I don't know if the sheriff's or county attorneys testified, Senator Latz. If they didn't, they should have. I don't like those little letters coming in without somebody coming to the table and saying this is what and why we shouldn't be passing this, frankly. But I should also make a note, too, that when you talk about the $500 car, that, you know, you're not going to spend $500 for an attorney to fight that. Law enforcement also, I know, and the county attorneys have the ability to say, you know, this car has to be paid off. This loan has to be paid off at the bank, quite frankly. It's not worth the work to go through it. And a lot of that goes back, and a lot of that does not get sold, too, because it does cost too much for the agencies. So I'm just very, very cautious, again, of moving forward with this, especially in light of the fact of the folks that are against this, and these are the ones that work so hard and do the job right. I just continue to have to pay for the Metro Gang Strike Force problems here, and I hope we don't have to continue years and years down the line to have to pay for the DNR's problems that they recently had. Quite frankly, that person has been dealt with, and I think there needs to be certainly some tweaks there when it comes to our personal data. But if you got a bad apple, it doesn't mean the rest of the state is all bad. So, thank you.
All right. Can we hear from Mr. Turner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, as you heard from Mr. McGrath, about one-third of all forfeiture cases actually get to the judicial stage. The courts determine that number would not go up or down, and therefore the court activity would remain the same. There is no fiscal impact to the state with this bill.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, if I may, wanted to address Senator Ingebrigtsen's point. I am not the person who has brought up the gang strike force. In fact, that is not the motivation for me at all in bringing this bill forward. And also, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think you've seen in my official capacity as a senator and in private conversations we've had, I have the utmost respect for law enforcement and what law enforcement does. That being said, I think everybody in this room understands I have a healthy skepticism about government power. And that's true when it comes to economics and taxation and regulation and the like. And it also is true when we give them guns and allow them to arrest people. And that doesn't mean that I don't have respect for legislators. It doesn't mean I don't have respect for people who work at the Department of Commerce. And it most certainly doesn't mean that I have a lack of respect for prosecutors or sheriffs or police officers or whomever. But I think it's always wise to check power. and watch it. And frankly, as I say, the strike force had nothing to do with it, in my view. I was frankly shocked to find out that you could literally be brought in on charges, lose your property, never be charged with anything, be let go, and if you don't take the initiative to bring a case yourself, not get your property back. That to me is shocking, irrespective of anything else, and I'm certain we'll have this debate on the floor. And by the way, to Senator Bonnehoff's point, I've been spoken to by my own county attorney and the Rice County attorney and other folks and police officers, so I'm well aware of the arguments on both sides, but I'm kind of a civil libertarian, and I feel good about this bill, and I thank you for the robust debate we've had here.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just add that, the Metro Gang Strike Force was kind of an outlier. I mean, I recognize that, and for me, too, this is not about them. This is about the underlying policy. To Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, yeah, we did have the testimony from law enforcement as well at the Judiciary Committee, and the bill passed out with overwhelming support.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonnehoff.
Thank you. And in defense of Senator Thompson, I will say this probably isn't the place where the bill would either be passed or not passed, because it did pass out of Judiciary, and so I did want to register the opposition on behalf of those whom I spoke, but I do believe that the discussion should be taken to the floor.
Senator Latz, did you want to?
I'll move the bill.
Okay.
Sorry. Get the division report in on this one?
We already did adopt the division report.
Then I'll move the bill.
So Senator Latz moves that Senate file 874 be as amended, be recommended to be passed. Any other discussion on it? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign.
No.
Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. And that is referred. That is referred to the floor. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, Senator Latz and my other co-authors, thank you for the help that you've given, and everybody have a good day.
Members, there is a change on the schedule. I believe Senate File 266 will not be heard, so you can cross that off. And then, do we have to get?
It's not on here.
It's right there.
All right, and members, unfortunately, the other two authors are not here at the time, and so we're going to have to recess and come back at 6 p.m. tonight.
But Thursday morning is canceled.
The good news is that Thursday morning is not going to, we're not going to have a finance committee meeting Thursday morning.
But Friday
morning.
You got that part.
So, members, we will recess until 6 p.m. tonight. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
I'm sorry, you said Friday. Do we have a list of those?
Friday morning. I did, yeah. So.
Okay, so those
excited about missing committee tomorrow morning.
Those are no, I don't care about that. Those are posted. Those bills are posted there.
So thank you, members, for the participation. And see you.
We don't have that. We don't have time.